So whenever you're ready.
Okay, so let's get started. So today we get to talk about the future of data archiving and data management and what it can bring us. I'll kick off with a few introductory comments in a moment. Then I'm going to hand over to Alan to talk about things like reproducible research and the next generation of meta-analyses. Then we're going to have John Kuntze on, are you doing data publication?
Yeah.
Right. So publication data and what that implies. Then I'm going to hand over to Patricia Cruz, who's talking about the different models for publication of data, the sort of the dryad type model versus the data one type model. Then Robert is going to be talking about integrated databases and standards for data. And then so we have Don at the end to do this?
We'll do it if he can make it.
If Don can make it, we'll have him on so the future standards, expectations and requirements. If not, we'll come to that topic anyway. And hopefully we can leave some time for this general discussion at the end today, so we can maybe be sort of through the presentations and discussions around them by about 3:30-ish, then we'd probably leave half an hour if we get into that. So in terms of what the prospects are for archive, what archive data archiving can give us, I think it's sort of set against a background of ecology and evolution becoming more interdisciplinary. And this is shown both in the increasing numbers of authors on the average article and calls for new programs from granting agencies that are interdisciplinary, as well as things like interdisciplinary training programs like the IGRT programs on campus, for example. And then we've got the environmental disaster that recently happened with the Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico is a poignant reminder of the unexpected value of ecological data and environmental data. So, you know, data on species diversity, population levels, ecotoxicological things, water chemistry, fisheries, oceanographic conditions, economic data from fishermen and from people reliant on tourism in that area, all of those kind of things and more were suddenly in demand. And it became patently clear that we didn't have a lot of those data readily available. Many historical survey data were perhaps lost or at least inaccessible. And so disasters like that are one of the things that sort of makes it very clear that data can become useful for unexpected purposes and purposes that we don't foresee at the time of conducting a study. There's an estimate that apparently about 1% of data remains accessible after the publication of results in scientific studies. So the other 99% of it is lost. That figure comes from a recent science paper that was in a special feature about data archiving. In terms of data archiving, there are sort of there's three main challenges that people are perceiving. There's the problem of dispersion of data. The data is in many different places, and that's sort of describes the need for things like data one. Then we have the heterogeneity of data sets in different places and different forms of data that range from video media to data file to documents of various kinds and on and on. The need for overcoming that kind of heterogeneity amongst data sets with things like XML and EML as metadata languages, and things like the semantic web as a way of resolving what terms are related in facilitating searches. And that's something we actually haven't talked about much yet, is the semantic web, so maybe you could say something about it a bit later. And then there's the problem of provenance, that is, talking about the origins and history of data and knowing what those are and having that information available. And so some of that is recording from an ecological evolutionary perspective is knowing the context for when data was collected. Are there additional environmental data from that time that are relevant and should be preserved? Is it a matter of attaching the collected data to a paper that already describes methods and background conditions and so on? And let me finish up by talking about a few survey of scientists that was conducted by Science Magazine that sort of reveals a bit about where we're at with data archiving. So some 56% of scientists said they rarely use data from published sources or from archives. On the flip side, there were 23% of scientists who said they regularly used published data or data from archives in their work. Okay? And that's across all disciplines of science. So there's a lot of, there is a substantial amount of current usage, but there's a lot of scientists who could still potentially benefit from increasing their usage of existing data. And similarly, about 56% of scientists had requested data from a published source, so from authors who had published a paper, they had contacted them and said, can we get access to your data? And 48% of scientists said they had received published data. So the majority of people that asked actually got the data. Most of the data sets that scientists are using are small. They are less than 1 gigabyte. And the storage of them is bad, basically, at present, as you probably all know. Over 50% of data sets end up just stored in the lab. 40% on a university server, and then only 8% in community repositories that have some kind of archival role. Okay, so and what scientists think about their own data storage and its value, it was that some 38% of scientists actually thought that their data storage was permanent. The facts and figures don't bear that out in terms of how many data sets have remained accessible. But surprisingly, there was something like 17% of scientists who acknowledged they don't try and keep their data for more than 5 years. They viewed it as having little value beyond that time, so they really didn't attempt to keep it in the long term, even though it's stuff they put effort into collecting. And then in terms of data analysis, so if we actually get data from archives or public sources, there was something like 30% of researchers who felt that given their current collaborations or their own expertise, those 30% of people felt they hadn't got the expertise to be able to analyze their data in the way they needed to. So they didn't really sort of know quite where they were going to get that expertise or would talk to somebody. So there's a great potential for increasing the availability of analytical techniques, and as more data sets become available, we're going to want techniques that are the next generation of meta-analyses that can use existing data more thoroughly than the rather reduced metrics that get used in meta-analyses. So quite often it would just be an R-squared or an average effect size in a meta-analysis, but there is a lot more information in the complete data sets if we could use them, but then we've got to overcome the heterogeneity from one study to another to achieve that. So that's the challenge. And finally, in terms of the value of making data accessible, the sort of will it make me rich and famous kind of question, there is a somewhat positive answer to that. The only study of it I know is by Heather Piwowa and colleagues, and came out recently. And they reviewed 86 cancer studies, and there was actually 69% of studies made their data accessible to the public by putting it in an archive, and those on average, those studies also had an exactly 69% increase in their citation during some, I think it was like a 5-year period since publication. And so there was a clear benefit and a statistically significant increase in citations of those papers that had made their data available. And so as a scientist, we could potentially gain from it. So I'm going to hand over to, I believe, Alan, to say something about reproducible research and the next generation of meta-analyses, or if we
don't want to express. That's a question just about that last paper, I didn't read it.
Yeah.
Is it causal, or is it just that certain successful scientists publish their data?
Because
you could look at that, whose science didn't actually use the data or just refer to it.
That study did not make that clear as far as I'm aware, and that would be an interesting thing to look at, obviously. You could look at the existing citation records of the authors, for example, something like that.
But also, if this increased citation is just a normal citation, or is it because people actually reuse the data?
And this affects your theme that you brought up yesterday, being able to distinguish between citations that are going to the data and citations that are referring to a paper, or why people are citing.
Right, and also the it could be that if you have if you've made the data accessible, that is taken as an increased transparency of that study, and so people believe that study more. So that was the I believe, was it Biometry, the journal that has now a data editor, an editor for the reproducibility of results. And if that editor can reproduce your results with your code and your data, then your paper gets that stamp of approval on it. And so it's that added value. So it could be some of that as well that's going on, and that's an explicit mechanism for it.
Biostatistics. Okay. Thank you. So, Alan, can you comment on, so we talk about there being more data that's accessible. Do you see that we would do a meta-analysis in any different way that someone could say, like, well, why haven't you, for instance, looked at these other data sets and repeated the analysis if all of the data is available and the methods are available to redo them, as opposed to sort of summarizing sort of the results of all of these things? How might this world look different as we have all of that data sort of accessible to all of the authors?
So we are in an era where there's been a great changing view about sort of the relationship between essentially data and theory, or and the uses of data in ecology. It sort of, in some sense, maybe wasn't caused by NCES, the National Center for Ecological Analysis, but it certainly played a major role in emphasizing the importance of meta-analyses. And that then brings up some of the issues that are very important, is how you really do this properly, how you properly take into account data sets that are very different. And as we're moving to a new era where especially ecologists are trying to put together not only ecological data, but data from the social sciences, et cetera, into a unified framework, that you run into problems of how you integrate data of very, very different forms in a sensible way. And at the same time, some of what we were sort of restricted to doing with some meta-analyses, we now have far fewer restrictions as some of the kinds of statistical analyses that you would have wanted to do or want to do, where previously you would have been restricted essentially by computer time or computer speed of computers, that there's been a revolution in terms of being able to do model-based statistics, because we now have the computational power to essentially do that at our desk. So this then feeds into a new view of how you should think about putting together multiple data sets. And what's interesting is that NC's funding is running out. It's being replaced by a new center. They're not allowed to announce it, but everybody in the world knows where it's going to go and what it's going to be like to some extent. It's going to be run by the University of Maryland at ANAP, and it's going to be located in Annapolis. And their view there is going to be much more sort of flexibility, not taking the same view that everything should be just a straightforward meta-analysis. And this then leads to wanting to examine another sort of player that's going to really, in some sense, potentially revolutionize the way that we think about data in ecology. So one problem with meta-analyses that people always referred to, which ties very much into some of the other issues, is that people tend to only publish, in some sense, positive results. So the data that you see is definitely not a random subset of all the data that could or has been collected. So NEON, and I would urge all of you to go look at the NEON website. There's all sorts of interesting aspects there. NEON is the National Ecological Observatory Network. And it's sort of spinning up right now. There will be 20 sites, main sites across the country, distributed in a slightly bizarre fashion. Having enough trouble by complaining about that at every meeting, I'll stop momentarily as to why California did not have what it wants. But they have a huge number of data products that they're going to reproduce. And even in discussions there, people raise an interesting issue. As you went, for example, from something as simple, as straightforward as recording temperature, from older methods of recording it to new ones, that they properly went through sort of a long overlap to try and make sure that those figures were actually comparable. And so then this raises an issue as you get more and more new data. How do you make sure that it, in some sense, is comparable to data that you already have? And what's interesting about NEON is that it sort of thinks about sort of four levels of data. So raw data from instruments or human observations, then there's calibrated data, so that then has information essentially on data quality. That first was level zero, that's level one. Then level two, you combine it to to take care of gaps, for example, the fact that you only have 20 sites or you're not recording continuously in time, and there's various other aspects. Then you have level three, which is you do it on the uniform space-time grid, and then essentially derived products, level four, which put together different pieces. And what's interesting is that this model works very, very well to some extent for some of the more physical data that they're collecting. Like they give an example of data from an infrared gas analyzer measuring carbon dioxide at six individual heights. There's going to be a tower every one of the 20 locations. Then you can easily see how you spin that up to the different levels, calibrated values of carbon dioxide dryer mixing at six individual heights, and then you do it, you fill it in across the different heights, and then you do it at spatial locations, etc. If you try to do it with another example they give of something like tree circumferences and tree cover and tree biomass, etc., a lot of this gets a lot fuzzier and depends much more critically on the particular models that are used. And once you start to look at species interactions, it gets even trickier. So there's some real issues that are being raised here. And I'll throw out one more bit about NEON and then stop, which is they have sort of an interesting converse to the should I publish a data paper. So they've been hiring scientists to be NEON staff members, getting PhD-level scientists. And they've got the converse. They're hired basically to manage and create a data screen. And how do you make a career there where they've got to be very careful about have these people having, in some sense, better access to the data than the community as a whole, because the community as a whole has supported, in some sense, or is supporting, and the nation as a whole, is supporting the creation of this data network. And I know, for example, say, high-energy physicists may have faced some of these issues, but it's a little bit different here.
Well, another issue that we have discussed that was raised is in training students to be prepared to work in the world where this is the kind of data they face and the kind of skills. Can you comment on what might be necessary that's already in our curriculums or changing our curriculums that help will prepare the next generation of students for this kind of data?
Well, one sense is that, and I'll turn to you, I mean, you were forced by your fellowship to take courses in computer science, which probably ahead of time you did not realize how valuable they would be. And so very few biologists get any training in databases. I mean, I'm sure Robert could comment on that. And database structures, and so I think this is something you don't really need to know anything about. You know, just use Excel or something. That there really is a great deal to be learned there, just as we sort of think about training in other areas. Now, it's probably not realistic to expect everybody's going to be an expert, but we have to have people have at least enough knowledge and expertise to talk to people who are experts in these areas, and simultaneously to have people in computer science and other areas that are, have enough of the biological language to talk to the ecologist, who come in with a very different set of problems than other areas of even of biology, let alone areas like physics.
So open that to our instructors and professors. How do you approach that, Robert?
Well, I don't know how to approach it, but I certainly agree with Alan. I tend to say to students that I believe that skill of incoming students has declined over the past 10, 20 years in computer usage. So 20 years ago, you had to use DOS, and you had to sort of be, anything you did was somewhat programming oriented. And now, how is it possible that any computer students are fine if they all, you know, they all use sort of a browser or nice interfaces, and those are great, but they don't set you up to do research with large data sets. And so I see a huge gap there. And so we had a discussion in the ecology group last year to talk about should we maintain physics or chemistry as a prereq? But nobody talked about what about computer science or how do we bring that in. So we need to clearly bring that more to the table, because I frequently come across people who have great ideas and just have no way how to connect all the stuff that's out there. So there's a big gap. Some just pick it up for one reason or another. Not everybody will get as far as everybody else, but clearly more people need to at least have their eyes open about what's out there, and then either learn themselves or know where to find help or how to go about it, what language to speak.
And Marcel, a student came to you in first year of college and said, what should I do?
It would be I would not know of a course I could direct them to that I think is appropriately interdisciplinary, in that it's learning about the databases that are out there, things like Alan was just talking about, the different levels of data we have, knowing about the ways we connect databases together, like, you know, I've learned about Data One, what it does because I had to, similarly learning what some of the other basics of the way we transport information around and access it are. It would be something that's enormously valuable for graduate students. And so, I think most starting graduate students don't know what a DOI is, and just knowing what that does for us and why it's valuable and things like that. It seems like there could be a few introductory lectures that would just open up a new world. Then I think the next level up is to sort of get somebody to have more of a computer science training like you've had, that would enable them to start to know enough about database structure and so on that they can start to bring that into their own work. And similarly, at the other end of things, the majority of graduate students never learn beyond the conceptual idea what a meta-analysis is. At best, they would be able to see typical meta-analysis results figures and look at that and say, and interpret it. But the mechanics of what's gone into making that, the assumptions and so on, and let alone how you actually do a meta-analysis, is something that's beyond, I think, most graduate students. And like many other forms of statistics, is something that's missing in our graduate training, and something that we could usefully add in by drawing on expertise that's around already in the university.
I would just also add to that, I think, first, and maybe this is already in the curriculum, so apologies if I'm speaking out of turn, is just having a course, a lecture that says why it's important to share data. I think here we're talking about that, but that might not be a common knowledge of, hey, let's share data, an interdisciplinary approach, what are the advantages of sharing data across disciplines and bringing in population data with other kinds of data, et cetera. And the pros and cons of doing that, and looking at if Heather Pugelbar's paper is indeed correct, that citation rates increase and things like that. So
maybe we should move on to our next speaker with you.
I was going to say one more comment. It is perhaps possible that this new synthesis center may do for some of this sort of essentially computer science or database issues what NCs did for meta-analyses, because they are going to have much more in the way of support for the people working there from professional computer scientists or people who are professionals in that area. So it is a possibility that this may move forward.
Okay, so John, would you like to share this with me? You need to be somewhere
about
where I am.
Stand camera. I think there's people have been missing their PowerPoint, so I'm going to fill in for you. I have three slides, thankfully, only three. The topic is this concept of a data paper. We've been asked by the Moore, Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation to look into how we could, one might approach how scientists are actually dealing with information about the processing information that goes along with data they generate. There's a data archiving problem which has already gotten a certain amount of attention, but what was neglected was this sort of processing, you know, algorithms, techniques, extra analysis, and all sorts of things that are missing, like credit to, you know, hundreds of people who participated in the development of this data. It's particularly true for synthesis data, where you're pulling data from 50 different data sets, you know, you're combining them. This, you know, stuff that's without the processing information, the science is completely irreproducible, or the results that are published. So we're looking at that problem, and in doing so, we wrote up an analysis, interviewed a bunch of scientists, and we kind of concluded that we don't really, it's not a good idea to decouple the sort of capture preservation of the data, the processing information independent of the data itself, because they kind of go together and there's a duality between them. Anyway, what we came up with was a sort of a vision for this concept of how do you capture all of this stuff, these data products, the processing information and the data itself. And there's a sort of a simple idea, which may be, the simple idea is to take this unusual material, this data products, and wrap it in a familiar facade. Essentially, try to turn it into something that you could sort of pass off as a kind of a paper. So basically, you create stable storage. You put you archive your data products, that's the data sets and the processing information. You slap a cover sheet on it. The cover sheet would minimally consist of familiar elements like title, authors, an abstract, a date, a persistent identifier. And if you just did that and no more, you could add hundreds of pages of narrative if you wanted, but if that's all you did, you could submit that to Google Scholar and get on the boards, essentially, with search engines. You would have a familiar, you know, people came across this and go, I know what that is, it's a paper. It looks like the cover sheet of a paper. And actually, it's a cover sheet for a data, set of data products. But it's a way of sort of getting into the door in a way that will hopefully ease adoption. So it also gives you these data elements, at the minimum, would give you enough information to create a data citation and give you an identifier that gave you the kind of confidence that we're used to getting. So it's, again, it's building that sort of trust. Over time, we would expect that we could take this minimal set of elements and then add to them more discipline-specific, deeper, richer kinds of metadata. But just getting started is what we're looking at. So we want to actually create this sort of vision and implement this in a pilot, and this is something we're pursuing at the California Digital Library with our publishing group.
Would this be reviewed?
So that's a good question. So our publishing group, in fact, supports about 40 online journals, including some subset of those are peer-reviewed. So you have the option to create data journals. There's this concept of the overlay journal that Jim Gray wrote about before he passed away. Essentially, it's you capture these data products, and they can be distributed in archives all over the world. but you sort of bring them together under one umbrella, this sort of journal, table of contents. You develop, you get an editor, you get develop an editorial policy, a submission policy, and then you link to these in repositories all over the place. It's an online only, and the idea is that the contents are distributed. Now you could take that journal and take some subset of those and apply peer review to them.
No, but what would be the criteria for reviewing that data paper?
Okay, so I'm more out of my depth there, but I think our publishing group has things to say, and we'd certainly like to hear from the community as well. One of the things that, and Jim, what you were talking about yesterday makes me think of this, is if we look at this sort of set of stairs, we feel like if we can do this right, you don't have to do the whole darn thing to get, you know, data journal. But in fact, if you start at the bottom, each step here gives you an increment of value for an increment of effort. If all you do is get your data products stored in shareable storage, shared and stable storage with identifiers that are persistent, that's a win already. That's the bottom line. Now, if you get up there and then you actually put a cover sheet on them, you've created a data paper. Now you've got visibility to search engines. And you've got a sort of an entree, you know, to those people who, I don't know what a data set, but I know what a cover sheet is.
But you at least want some level of clarity and labeling of the data,
right,
and so forth. I mean, I can't remember 2 years ago what these numbers mean, you know, and so there's got to be some, you know, minimum standard of labeling and that sort of thing. That would seem to be as part of the criteria here, even at that first tier.
Right. So one of the ideas here is also because data is so opaque, a lot of its value is not known until it's used. But if you get it into a place where you can share it, early versions of it, it'll be annotated, corrected, used. Errors will be driven out of new versions that we put up. And these are all things which could build towards the decision to submit it for publication to an overlay journal, which would be the third step there. And then some subset of those could be peer-reviewed at the top level. So we have components of, we've got people who know publishing at the CDL. We can do the archival portion of it. But we hope that this stair approach will help.
John, to clarify, when you say overlay journal, do you mean a journal that is currently affiliated with the UC3 system, or do you mean any sort of peer-reviewed journal we choose to submit to? What do you mean by that?
New journals. Creation of new journals, but Fisher wants to.
But journals that are potentially using the data stored, any journal that's saying, okay, I know this data set, it's a reputable data set, and it's part of my study and I'm referencing it.
Yeah, but your question's also making me think this is an incomplete picture, because this is talking about, you know, ground up sets of journals based on data papers. There's no reason the traditional literature cannot link to any one of these data sets from existing journals. That could become a habit,
right.
As well.
Like it could be a benefit of this kind of a system to make.
Yeah.
And if that was the case, presumably at some point in this, there would be an identifier, a DOI number for the data set, so that it's referenceable by an outside source. And what point in this would you foresee that, or is that?
At the very bottom, stage. Would give the basic minimal set you'd get is you apply a title, abstract, author list,
so there's an
identifier.
There's immediately a benefit then,
yeah,
to the user in having that available, as well as having their data stored. They've got that extra benefit.
Yeah.
So it's good.
You're storing them even at the lowest level, every single version of the data set, are you?
Well, there are policies that could determine whether you store every single version or not. We build a certain technology, and there will be, our instance of it could have a certain policy. Mm-hmm. Now, the idea is that you want to store every single version. In reality, do you have the money to store every single version, and what is a single version?
Well, I don't know, but that's why I asked. Part of why I asked the question is, of course, if I reference to a specific data set and I say I analyzed it and this is where I conclude, somebody goes back to it and says, you know, you were wrong, or did the data change? Okay, so,
and this is where the disciplines really need to help, step in and help, because we won't know the we won't know as archivists the value of that data until it's blessed by or peer or viewed.
And so there's a point where the investigator who has put that data into the archive could say, this is the point where it is a somewhat final piece of data in terms of I started putting data in here perhaps when I was still conducting my investigation, and it was it served as a storage and archiving at that point. But now I've completed data collection, and it's appropriate now for a DOI to be issued and for it to be a version. So I think the user has some, if the user has some input into that, within policies.
Our system is based on, if you decide, I want this version to be thrown away, that's your decision. We do no throwing away for the user. It's mm-hmm. all up to the submitter, the owner, the creator of that data.
Right.
So if you wrote a paper and you used one version, then you added more data to that, and 2 years later you write another paper, we're not going to throw away that other version because you're probably going to reference it in some way.
But at least for me as a user of the system, that means that I use data, I need to download it and stick it in my own repository.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what I use, and the owner may leave it.
Yeah, well, that's why you need a persistent to say why it's important to keep.
Well, we have to share it, but who am I? You know, so
I think also one of the benefits to these getting stable identifiers in there, it'll help communication around these very issues. I mean, we've got preprints and postprints are appearing, all sorts of versions of these things. How do we know they're going to be there if you cite the preprint? But if discussion around this is enabled and these identifiers can be very searchable, presumably announcements could be made, better communication to users who would say, gosh, how risky is it for me to cite this thing? Let me go and find out. I can ask about this. In fact, the rug won't be pulled out from under my feet if I just cite one version, the next version, and rerun, you know, it still works in the next version, I know that's stable, as opposed to the version, you know, whatever. So we don't, it's not a closed, shut door, under, you know, solution, but we think we're moving towards a good place. So the last, just to sort of to sum it up, we think that the outcome will be authors, researchers will routinely be motivated to deposit their data in stable storage, get persistent identifiers that can be precisely linked to from traditional publications, and they can do this for author credits, to be data authors then, right? And this will include large numbers of people who got their PhD and they are not publishing regular papers, but they're doing incredibly valuable work and they can get credit for it. We believe that these data journals can spring up around various disciplines, even if the papers are distributed geographically across different archives. The products will be improved because they'll be reused. They'll be used more often, reused and annotated and corrected. And a lot of data nobody knows its value until it's annotated. There's certain biological data, nobody knows. We're working with this group, NISO, the National Information Standards Organization, and NFACE, which I forget what it stands for, but they're looking at the whole supplemental materials question. That data information that's not published because it doesn't fit in the traditional publishing format, and that includes segments of things that are related but not essential, or not integral to the content, and that which is related but is perhaps inessential or less essential. So,
can I test it there?
So
for the audience, one of the things that it turns out with supplemental data is that it is not, just because you've published a paper and you've added supplemental data to that, there is no guarantee that that supplemental data is permanent. There are cases where journals have changed publisher, and the publisher had no requirement to transfer the supplemental data over to the new publisher, and they didn't, and so it was lost. There's also cases where journals have lost supplemental data and had to try and get it back from the authors. So supplemental data, publication of that, is no guarantee of permanency of information. So the simple step of putting all your data in a supplement falls short of what data archiving is trying to achieve.
Yeah, so this is taking a stab at that problem. These data papers, which would cover the whole range of data products, and in which we imagine you could label sections of it as essential, of what the author deems essential, and therefore directing peer review, if it's going there, to concentrate on this and forget this stuff, which is non-essential, but I'm submitting it. All of it can be saved. The bottom line is that the data products, including all the synthesis efforts, which are almost never saved, will enter the scientific record instead of being lost.
So I've got to run to a meeting. I want to get my questions in here, but I come back to this criteria again, because I think we all have tons of data that's like, well, you can't publish it or whatever. And so that turned into a data dump. I mean, I can see the data that's been published in a peer-reviewed journal, that's there's some vetting there that would be deemed quality data at some level. But the data that's never been published, maybe there's a reason for that too. And I know that's not what you do, but it seems to me that this data publishing has got to address that, those kind of
issues. Yeah, and that's why we're partnering with the publishing group, because they know how to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In this room, there's an ecosystem of peer-reviewed and non-peer-reviewed journal. They both have their own their places and their niches. So, yeah.
We should probably move on to Patricia's presentation, yeah, if we can.
So I'm going to talk primarily about Data One and not necessarily about the difference of Data One and Dryad. Primarily because, as I'll point out in my talk, Dryad is part of Data One, so they're not really in conflict with each other. In fact, they're really embedded with each other. So what the slides I'm going to show you, they're hot off the press from our, we just completed an NSF review last week on the Data One project, and NSF's really liked what they saw. So these are just the introductory slides from that NSF review. So they're very high level, and I apologize if they're too high of a level, but I think they'll give you an idea about what Data One is. Essentially, Data One is addressing the science challenges that we're facing with climate change and some of the issues that go along with facing those challenges, and bringing the enormous amount of data together that will help mitigate climate change. And I think as in the opening remarks, we talked a little bit about what some of the challenges are associated with bringing a lot of data together. First are the technical challenges, the amazing amount of data that can come your way, whether it's for sensors or sensor networks, just a huge amount of data. The data in every journal that you see has an article on the data deluge and that we're being overtaxed with data, et cetera. There's a huge amount. How do you sort through it? The data challenges also are, once you get that data, is understanding what to do with it. The heterogeneity of that data, the way you say potato, I say patata, that goes for data as well. That almost rhymed. And everybody has a different way of writing a date, et cetera, et cetera. And then the data is incredibly distributed, and how do you find that data? And then not only the challenges of the data itself, but really the individual challenges and some of the things that we're talking about here today, and those challenges span the whole information life cycle of data. When you collect it, to describe it, deposit it, what is a data management plan, what is metadata, how much will it cost, who's going to pay, where am I going to preserve it, how am I going to get credit, I'm up for review, oh my God, sky is falling. And so these are all questions, very real questions, that I think both as institutions and disciplines, we're all wrestling with these same things. And these are early days and really exciting days, I think I would add to that, that we have a real opportunity to shape what this is going to look like. So that's why I'm excited about this. So Data One is really answering some of those questions, and they're doing that in two ways. First is building cyber infrastructure. And that cyber infrastructure consists of three things. Data One, two ways. First thing, cyber infrastructure. And that is member nodes. And that is distributed data archives. And those data archives are around the world. They serve local community. And they provide resources for managing the data at the local level. And that's also a data replication strategy. So if we happen to have an earthquake in San Francisco and our data goes offline, we know that the earthquake, our data that's not on an earthquake fault will be safe, et cetera. And so that's the first component of the cyber infrastructure. The second thing is something called the coordinating nodes, and there's three of those. It's at the NCES at UC Santa Barbara. The other coordinating node is University of New Mexico. The coordinating nodes are the orange guys. So that's NCES right there. It's kind of covering from Tijuana up to Mono Lake, but that's NCES. University of New Mexico, where Bill Michener, the PI, sits on the project, and the other one is at Oak Ridge National Lab. And so those are the three coordinating nodes. And they provide the services for the member nodes, they have the metadata catalog, the index tools for searching across all of that data that's in those member nodes, the replication services, and assuring that there's a high availability of that content. On top of that, the coordinating nodes, member nodes, is something called the Investigator Toolkit. And what the Investigator Toolkit is are tools that help the researcher describe their data, collect their data, find their data, etc. And these are just a variety, a list of the initial things that we're working with in the Investigator Toolkit. And in the next month or so, we're going to be coming out with a demo that I think will make all of this a lot clearer of how Morpho, etc. fits in to the Investigator Toolkit. So Data One, it's also about community, and I think this came up earlier, that how do we get on the same page of describing and using data and sharing data? And it's the bioinformatics community, it's the computer scientists, it's the librarians, it's the environmental scientists in the field collecting cores in a marsh, et cetera. It's everybody coming together around that to figure out what that solution is. So the community side of Data One is we're building a lot of curricula, et cetera, that is informing people about how to collect data, why they need to describe it, how to describe it, workshops, et cetera. And so this is a big focus on Data One is changing that community of practice so people are comfortable with that. And so Dryad, the question, that's Todd Vision right there, so Dryad. And he, so we right now have up three member nodes. They're our kickoff member nodes. Dryad is one of our first member nodes, and along with the NCES, KMB is also a member node, and the Oak Ridge National Lab, the DAC, if any of you are familiar with the DAC. The next round of member nodes, the CDL will become a member node. So any of the data that you put into our repository can be part of the Data One network if that's desirable. So these next few slides, these are kind of corny, but I think it'll give you an idea of what Data One, why a research scientist would use it. Traditionally, somebody, when they're looking, they're starting a project and they're looking for data, they have to go to a variety of different places to find the data. You need to call a PI, you need to really track that down. And often, it's if you don't know that data source, et cetera, you're going to have a really hard time finding it. So Data One is, the idea is that you don't have to go to all those different sources, an integrated view of all those data sets, and it makes life much easier. As data are added onto that, Data One will bring in new networks of data, et cetera.
So, Trish, quick question. Yeah. So I like the cloud graphic in the middle of that one, as it kind of sums up my question as sort of, we have to most of us, Data One is this amorphous structure of many
component organizations, and how much do you think the average scientist needs to know about Data One? Can it remain as an amorphous cloud that we is doing what we want it to do, or are there things that you think we should know about it?
Well, I think there's things that you need to know about it in terms of what the benefits of Data One are, and why you want to be a part of Data One. Because I think if you know that, you're going to be describing your data in a particular way and using the Data One tools because they're going to make your life easier, we think, in order to participate in this. I think one of the challenging parts of Data One is we're building a huge, massive cyber infrastructure. That is going to be our first kind of operational services are going to be available in probably, I believe, August of this year. Is that it, John?
Sounds about right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of, we go out and talk about this a lot, and people are saying, well, where's the there? How can I see it and use it? And I think once we have something tangible available to the community, it'll become a lot clearer of how you can use it, how you need to know about it, and et cetera. But, you know, if you're a scientist at, let's say, at a Natural History Museum at UC Berkeley, you might not need to know about Data One at all, because you just are, the merit member node at the CDL for the UC. You don't care about Data One. You might not be using that data, but you're a contributor to that.
I think, on a technical level, I think you won't need to know the structure of Data One. You need to know how to get to the cloud to say, conduct a search, but you'll be redirected to, if you're reading data, you'll be redirected to wherever it is, and there's high availability going on, so if the node is down, it'll be redirected to a replica. Mm-hmm. And if you're contributing data, you contribute it to the cloud, and you don't need to know where it goes. So you need to know just the one location.
Thank you, Dr.
So here's the tools that are currently, that are in Data One, that are part of the data that support the whole data lifecycle tool, and they're kind of mapped to the different parts of the data lifecycle. And again, once Data One is available to the community in August, these tools will be usable, et cetera. So, kind of stay tuned on that front. And so, again, just our vision and our approach is to build on existing cyber infrastructure. There's a huge amount of data that's already out there. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We really want to take what's available, take what the community is using, and create new cyber infrastructure where we need to, where it doesn't exist, and how to knit all of these different data archives that are out there. And then support new communities of practice, so bringing people together so they can use Data One in new ways. So that's just like the really 40,000 foot approach. So for the UCs, Data One is NC's folks are co-PIs, Matt Jones and Stephanie Hampton, if any of you are familiar with them. Bertram Ludisher at UC Davis is a co-I on Data One. And I'm trying to think if there's other UC folks.
Who funds Data One?
NSF. It's $20 million, 5 years, and then add-on funding.
So like most NSF projects, one wonders what happens after 5 or 10 years.
That's a great question, and I co-lead a work group with Bill Michener on sustainability. And our goal is to make Data One sustainable by year 8. And we're looking at a variety of ways to do that, of looking from foundational support to membership fees to subscription fees, et cetera, for the data. And looking to the private sector also for helping to pay for that.
Okay. Do you have any plans of unlocking additional data? What I refer to is that I think GBIF had a managed model where it made something similar for a much narrower region, so natural history data, but also invested a lot, I have the impression, in enabling museums and our collections to serve up their data. So far it seems you're taking the low-hanging fruit, like well-organized NCs and organizations that have it online, and then you put something around them, that's great, but sort of the next step would be
to really
get good data out there, just because it's not available in an easy way.
I completely agree, and that's for us one of the things that we want to work on within the University of California is to go for secondary funding to NSF and say, look, there's a potential for a lot of other resources and data archives to attach itself to Data One, but in order to do that, we need to do X, Y, and Z. It seems like NSF would look favorably upon that kind of funding, but I agree that there is a whole second tier of data that's out there that's really hidden in archives, et cetera. A lot of these field notebooks that were written around the turn of the century, I just think would be fascinating to digitize and have these part of that.
So maybe we can move on to Robert's perspective.
Yes, I don't have much to say actually so today, so that's all. I'll try to be brief. You never know, even if you don't have much to say myself, go on, so stop me. I was asked to speak a bit about,
integrating these databases and the reproducible thing.
Integrated database standards for data.
A couple things have come up around standards today is that, well, you can store all the data, and you can download it, and now what? So here, in some of those data has a cover sheet around it, a title and an author, and what is it? We can speak, if you wish, about sort of standards that we develop and how it works. But I think the thing I want to emphasize is that much of it is just basically very, very simple stuff. I've run into lots of problems, like for example with climate data, weather station data, elevation. What is it? Feet, meter? Well, for India, I had what was meter, but somebody thought it was feet, so they multiplied with 3. it take a while. Like everything 3 times too high in meters. What is it? And so forth. I've worked with income and poverty data across countries, trying to put it together. Everybody reports something else. Pre-tax income, after-tax income, poverty estimate based on income. You can never really get it together. So it's about getting as much as original data as you can, and just very simple descriptions of what these things actually are. The problem I've also come across is if you have metadata and people do fill it out, they're lazy. People are not lazy, we're all lazy. So one thing that comes to mind now is that I had this database I had to work with, and one field was called percentage sign HYV. What might it be? Okay, well, it was metadata. It said, all the fields, what they mean. And so what that meant was, on our letters, percentage of HIV. Okay. Well, it wasn't HIV, but HYV. So HYV would have known what it was. So it was HYV. Oh, I figured it out. It meant high yielding varieties. The other thing is we haven't really talked about much also is sort of completeness. I work a lot with agricultural data, crop experimental data. So, 3 days ago, somebody made the remark, well, we can often just recreate the data, it's cheaper than storing it. Well, maybe for genomics. If you want to do a field experiments with crops, those are very expensive. And often you just cannot reproduce them, certainly if you want to have time series or something. Almost everything is lost, basically, every year. It's just gone. People just don't keep it. But even if they do, they don't keep the data you would like to have to reanalyze it. So if I want to analyze a crop experiment, I'd like to know, well, where was it grown? What was the weather? People don't have any rain. Or if they do, they measured it and it was kept separately. That wasn't stored. What was the soil type? Who knows? My estimate from a soil map, obviously that's not going to be enough. So there's a lot of, so what I have to emphasize, and I'll finish with that, and unless you have more questions. And it also follows up on the question I asked you, you can make technology as much as you like, and I'm really excited about seeing all these projects, and I think we're making progress. But the human component in it it remains very important. Who's going to take the effort to make it all happen, to put data in and to describe it well? Engaging people and making truths at the universities while we're teaching and other ways to make them understand how valuable this for all of us, but also for themselves. You're trying to build into tools ways to, we talked about two days ago also, like, well, these dictionaries, if you were integrated in your word processor, it would make you go quicker. Those are the things I'll be looking for over the next years as a way to move this big puzzle forward.
So just to have you expand a little bit on that, there's several ways that we might be addressing those challenges, whether it is training people getting the data, whether it is tools so that now I can go and, as just a citizen, I can do bird counts by snapping a picture of a bird on my phone and it can automatically grab my GPS coordinates and my current weather and data about me and just tag it on there. So tools can perhaps make that easier. And then requirements can possibly make it easier. Where do you put your emphasis? What do you think is the best gap?
Well, yeah, I think be careful with requirements. Just first get everybody sort of across the street. Mm-hmm. And when they're there, then you kind of type the requirements, you know, okay. Because otherwise nobody will come. The tools, the example is great. I mean, we can just, they also, metadata often, you have to fill in things that you can, the computer would actually read in your file. So there's a lot of other ways to make life easier. So I think that's very nice. That's what I saw about sort of the neural kind of systems where the threshold is very low. We'll fix it later. That's what I my current thing. Because the biggest barrier seems to be this cultural device to the, well, why are you using it in the first place? And so the tools are simple, and the editors force you to also. There's some forcing in there, some teaching, and saying, telling you, well, this is really going to go. All these things need to come together. But I would keep the standards, the obligatory standards, a bit low at first.
Do you think there are, or do we still need sort of those use cases where you can hold up and say, like, here is the kind of study that someone was able to do by having all of that data, having the weather data and the soil data integrated when they were doing that, and here is an app might motivate, or do you think those kinds of studies are sort of, they get to come, or they're there and we don't know?
I don't think you're convinced, but someone has to pick up the bill. You know, so in my previous job, I worked for a large research institute where people weren't so easily convinced when I made this kind of a spiel, because they said, well, you know, if we do that, people are, you know, we send out seeds and, you know, I want them to send something back about them. They said, well, if you do that, then we won't get as much adoption of our product, or, well, so, you know, who's going to pay this person maintaining this? So there is a real cost thing that we haven't talked about so much. But otherwise, I don't need to be convinced, and I don't think that's that much of a problem.
So, you mentioned
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I have a question that's partly for Robert, but also for the people with sort of curatorial backgrounds. One of the things that I'm interested in understanding is the degree to which tools are being developed and communications are actually happening between people with biological expertise and people with formal expertise about storing and retrieving data and relating data to help us establish workflows from collection to analysis and sharing that actually allow us to make the most of our data and allow us to draw comparisons that we wouldn't necessarily anticipate. I mean, so basically I'm sort of talking around the edges of relational databases and, but it's biologists and, you know, scientists in all disciplines aren't going to spend enough time learning about entities and relationships and, you know, yeah, becoming experts in databases. And they shouldn't have to, right? So we should be developing tools that make it possible to lower that boundary.
You may remember I mentioned the Excel project yesterday. There was Excel add-in project that tried to take what scientists do with Excel.
And right.
Add this tool that's open source that would make it easier for them to share their data, publish it, and archive it from Excel directly without them having to learn about relational databases and, you know, normalization of their data. Just it'll do it. It would do it for them.
Well, but I mean, you need to know. I mean, it's sort of like, it kind of begs the questions that were coming up in the discussion of these vocabularies, the semantic web stuff. What are the sorts of data and what are the relationships among them? And is that necessarily transparent without actually conducting an interview with the investigator. You know what I mean? There are definitely some kinds of data, like sequential observations are a very common kind of data that you probably could extract a little vignette of how to store that and what kind of data are required, metadata are required. But
well, some of the,
curious what the state of the art is with that. And
I don't know if the state of the art is exactly, I can just comment and let other people chime in too, but I, you know, one of the ideas proposed for that Excel project is, gee, I'm beginning this study of, you know, looking at stream data. What should I be measuring? You know, it occurs to me to measure this and that, but I should actually be measuring this and that. So you might start your project, and one of these, this Excel add-in could do is, you know, it could suggest to you things. You know, you've got temperature and humidity. It is, well,
so my paper clip pops up and tells you anything, right?
We just said we will not do anything with the paper clip. It'll be a little starfish.
But this, and the idea would also be to sort of direct you towards, you know, standardized units, mm-hmm. direct you towards towards sites where, you know, you could actually sort of self learn, you could learn by yourself a little bit, get some guidance. That's short of conducting an actual interview with you, which is very labor intensive.
Right, so right, right.
It's not a closed form, perfect solution, but it's sort of edges.
But then these templates would be available, you know, that we would encourage people to contribute these templates, not in the Microsoft sense, but in the you know, kind of a data standard sense. Exactly. So, and then the other, and I think the mention of taking the headers and creating metadata out of that, you know, from those Excel forms and then exposing that, that's your descriptive metadata.
Except if it's percent HYP.
I know, but then you can normalize that. Yeah. You know, you're going to be saying, hey, hopefully that little paper clip is going to jump out and say, starfish is going to say, hey, that's not the right way to, so.
And okay. There'll still be percentage HYV, but it should be hopefully more and more rare, because, you know, sometimes you just need to be rare and nuanced.
Yeah.
But in other moments, that was an unnecessary choice. In many cases, that's
sure. Yeah.
Maybe we should ask if any other questions from the audience. If you have anything you want to ask, please feel free. Yes.
I'm curious for Trish, the relationship between, so there's data on net, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's funding data one in the data conservancy.
Correct.
So what's the relationship?
So. DataNet is the out of the Office of Cyber Infrastructure, and that's the program is the DataNets. And they funded two projects, the Data Conservancy and Data One, and those were funded, I don't know, it took them forever to fund it, so it's really hard to say when the start date actually was. I think it was 18 months ago. They just... Yeah, it took them about a year to actually
more than a year to actually approve it.
Yeah.
But they finally cut the checks and they backdated it. And so it's a senior review after 18 months.
Yeah.
You don't want to.
Yeah.
So, but then, in the data standards that are being developed, is there any mention of the whether data would be something that could be collected again? Or whether it is a completely unique piece of data. So, for example, something that comes from a lab experiment under standardized conditions is arguably repeatable, whereas a historical document is clearly one of a kind. And then the other related part of that would be how much would it cost under time of time of deposition to repeat that analysis.
It would be great to have that information. You can make archiving decisions about, you know, well, gee, if we have to get rid of something from our archive, let's...
Well, hopefully we never get to that stage, but listening to Jonathan Eisen talk about the idea that it may be less expensive to resequence something compared to store it in the data, it makes you wonder about those kind of things.
So to reframe that question, as Robert also brought up, especially on the cost of doing these various elements of your archiving and what you record, you're imagining you're writing a data management plan now to meet the system and set guidelines to how are researchers going to be choosing, so by what level do I answer each of these questions? At what point do I start archiving? I could write in there, will be recorded in this paper notebook, which I will burn in 3 years, and I could write in there, I will, you know, stick it on merit the moment I begin collecting the data.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, this is sort of what Don was also to speak as, how do we as a community sort of decide where that the standard is,
mm-hmm.
as a whole, and then for individual questions? Just anyone who wants to start off on that?
So there are, I mean, some issues that come up even right now with evaluation proposals are things like what data gets archived and how accessible it is, or sort of the general things that a community evaluating that from an NSF standpoint at this point look at. So things like permanence and access and what gets archived. And what gets archived, something that perhaps we haven't mentioned is that if there's stuff involving human subjects and anonymity, et cetera, and this you may think as ecologists we don't do that, but if we're doing at the interface between ecology and the social sciences, you're very much one that into that sort of issue.
So I think, you know, also you also have to think about costs. And I think you were saying what the average size of a data set in that science article, what was it, 0.5 gigabytes?
Something like that, yes.
Which costs about 55 cents a year to store in our system, which, you know, I think, so that's nothing.
Yeah.
So it's more the human costs that you need to think about of kind of describing that data and managing it. And so I would just put that out there as...
hearing that figure is kind of comforting, because then you can think of the fact that, let's say you do write a proposal,
mm-hmm.
that you would put in storage costs the same way that you would put in pay charges.
Exactly.
And the figure you're mentioning is one where you actually could put it enough, so in some sense, the interest on it would be enough to sort of store it in perpetuity, because one's assumption is that the cost of storage is
going to go down
rather than up.
So what about in terms
electricity
of
will go up? Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that?
Although electricity will go up.
Yeah.
So what about in the? I believe it was with reference to the merit system. There was the talk about developing a sort of more user-friendly kind of interface that would allow data entry. I think it was a Flickr-like interface. Was that what I remember?
Uh-huh.
Could you say a little bit more about what's envisioned there, how accessible it might be?
So we already have that available, and it's really. What we did try and design the merit system to look a lot like Flickr. There's a box and you browse your desktop for the data, and then it says what's the title, who's the creator, what's the date, and it gives you, you know, some help on entering the author name and the creator name, so it's hopefully going to be consistent. And then you hit upload, and then if you come back and you enter another data set and it's changed, it's a new version, so we version all the data. Everything gets a persistent identifier, a DOI or an ARC, your choice. So it's pretty simple, straight ahead.
One thing I'm quite interested in that, because you've also described it as just those nice user interface, but also there's an API, I believe, that I actually use Flickr exactly to keep my own images, because I can write into my computer code, you know, when you generate this figure,
mm-hmm.
put it here and make sure you put a copy of the code that created it and make sure you put the metadata on there. And I can't fail to do that because the computer does automatically have code bounds.
Yeah.
And it would be great for something like that to show up on my merit repository.
Yeah, and so there is an API.
Yeah, the API, you just ship it right out. It's a RESTful, it's a more RESTful interface.
So yeah, having those tools that are both user friendly but also computer friendly is quite.
Yeah, and so it's also if you are, let's say the two of you are working together and you don't want us to see your data,
mm-hmm.
that's up to you. You say I only want these people to see my data, and the rest, oh this little piece, let's make it public, and then you can make it publicly accessible. Or
this brings us to the trade-off that Jonathan had brought up yesterday. In do we? Call it maybe this is a question that was given to Achilles, right? Do you want your data to live forever, but to sort of not have much sort of glamour, not be sort of accessible and used by everybody, so it doesn't have all those bells and whistles? Or is it more important that the data is has this perhaps a short lifetime that is used by lots of people and cited by lots of people and then lost? So where do you stand on sort of the data, like when we're forced to make those choices, like as a scientist or as a software developer?
There's a question.
I'm hearing you talk about people's preferences for their data. Can you comment a bit on copyright guidelines and where that fits in?
I wouldn't attack onto that question, but we should answer yours, but this may also in an international perspective. So I was thinking about, this is the US where there's nowhere in the world such an open view on data sharing because of the federal government. As a approach, I think, and particularly in compared with Europe, where people are, where there's strong database protection laws and people are much more possessive. So intellectual property, copyright issues, also the international setting perhaps would be interesting too.
And when funding agencies come into things, or even more complicated, when you have some more local agency that is funding your research or a company funding your research, then data ownership and copyright issues become increasingly complex. And that's something that it seems like we, as a scientific community, we need more guidance on. And it's, I see that as one of the things that could come out of a data one-like framework as being having the knowledge to be able to make that transparent to us. And I've seen with something like photographic images that the knowledge over copyright of images and what that involves has become much more user accessible over the last 5 to 10 years, and that's partly because services like Flickr, we mentioned, as an image service, and similar kind of places have become mainstream media, and so there's become a need for it. And so presumably that could happen with data sets as well.
Yeah, this I'm organizing a workshop with a person by the name of Mackenzie Smith from MIT and the Creative Commons and Data One and the Data Conservancy, of an international workshop to think about what are the copyright issues and how can Creative Commons help on an international scale to share data. And so we're hoping to have that workshop in this summer, bringing together some people who think about it from a legal standpoint, but also people who are in the trenches and sharing data and creating data. And
that's a tough question. The lawyers tell us that copyright is for creative works, and that the temperature in Davis today is not a creative work, it's a fact, and so it's not copyrightable.
Correct.
Right? And so to what extent is the data that I generate the process that's creative, and this can even fall under the realm of copyright, and I can use existing legal tools. I mean, there's a group in Britain that has been trying to address that without something called the patent principles, and so I guess Creative Commons has been working to sort of say what's our position on.
They say
data.
You can't copyright data.
Right.
The way that one transforms something into something that's copyrightable is through peer review in the past, at least in terms of scientific publications. So one could easily see a similar thing developing where a data set that has been peer reviewed gains that additional value, and so that becomes something that's patentable. It's possible.
It was copyright, maybe not the term, I guess, for data, but it's intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
And so data can be, you can own data, and you can forbid other people to use it, depending on where you are. There's a lot of local laws. The EU has very stringent database protection laws that I would break, but it's something to deal for a long time. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, you couldn't protect the same data.
But I suspect it would be like with publishing, the European laws are what is driving a lot of copyright things in publishing. So it may be that Europe sets the precedent for the rest of the world in that. Maybe I can move people on, and so we've got a last minute or two here, so maybe I can just ask from the each of the panelists for sort of a closing thought for the audience on data archive. I'll start with Carl.
Well, not really panels, but
you're the chief organizer of this. So what would be the thing you would say that the people need to take away?
Well, I just think these are exciting times to look forward to as a young scientist and as a theoretical scientist who gets to benefit a lot from community available data, see the kinds of questions that we can answer, and to look and see our funders coming forth and saying, you know, we're taking the future of data seriously, and data management needs to be part of an NSF proposal, and NIH and DOE and so forth all have these requirements. To see our publishers, and I'm quite happy to be in a discipline in ecology and evolution where I think our publishers have some of the highest standards on what data sharing has to be, what decisions like what American Naturalist has come out and said, data needs to go with the publication. It's great fun to be able to reproduce someone's work and start building on it in a much faster way when the data is there and the tools are there, and you don't waste all of your time doing sort of, you know, looking around, trying to scrape through databases and do the stuff that's not science. I can get back to my science and do better science that way. So it's fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing how this is going to develop.
I'll go to Alan next, since he has to run. It's about Alan's parting thought.
I think that sort of echo Carl, that it's getting data there and sort of changing maybe the practices of having data be available. I know I've had cases where I've wanted to get data that it's only because I knew the person who wrote it that it was easy for me to get it. And then there are these classic things I know from working with Bob Costantino, his comment that ecologists would recognize the name Thomas Park and Park's Cribolian data was lost because one of the times that Park moved, the shoebox essentially didn't go with him, and there it went. And it would be really, really nice to get that original data again. That particular data set would be extraordinarily valuable. So changing times will make things much, much better. Excuse me.
I agree. I just think these are incredibly exciting times, and I think also it's a little bit stressful in that the University of California doesn't have a lot of funds to kind of take this up, so I think we need to be pretty creative and scrappy about how we move forward on this front, but I'm pretty confident that we can begin sharing and saving data. So.
Just to say, I think that the data copyright, well, I think it's now seen more of it as a sort of a licensing challenge. But this is really, really important for data sharing, and that as scientists, I urge scientists to not be shy about sharing, about offering very liberal access to data. That thing that is probably most prized by many scientists, except for being scooped, the threat of being scooped, is the thing that's most prized is going to be the attribution. So if you can do Creative Commons is currently recommending, I think, essentially a public domain license, a CC0, mm-hmm. and asking in addition for attribution if you use the data. And the community is, you know, people are pretty well behaved. There's censure mechanisms which prevent that. But if you do anything else, apparently it could totally destroy our early archive. It could be overwhelmed by legal fees. You know, any little bit of a data set, a corner of a data set used in this synthesis study could screw everything up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Not that much to add to it. I'm just very interested to see all the progress being made. I really like your question about how to how to get this back to the scientists. I think that there's still a lot of work to be done there. But there are a lot of opportunities to make all our lives just easier as an individual, at the same time contributing to a much greater good. I guess that's what we chose to do when we became researchers, so it's exciting that it's going to be easier to do.
Thanks. My parting shot would be that I would argue with the question that Carl posed a little while ago, is it better to have a dark archive that's permanent and the data safe but inaccessible, or a bright archive where your data is rapidly discovered, the live fast, die young strategy, but that may not be permanent. I'd say that's actually perhaps a bit of a false dichotomy, and we actually need to have the confidence that if we use one of the bigger archives, our data is going to be permanent, and it's only by using those archives they become fundable and permanent and important enough that they're made permanent. And so I would say get it out there, your data, and let the let the users of that data decide that future, and the users of those archives, in that if it isn't permanent, then chances are you as an individual haven't lost much. And if it is permanent and it gets discovered, then there's extra added value to what you're doing as well. So I'd like to thank all of the panelists, including those from the other days, for participation in this, and I think especially Carl Bettinger for organizing this workshop and making it happen. And thank you also for the UC Free folks and CDL folks for coming along and participating in this workshop.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's great.